This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, September 20th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. CAI's Gilda Geist speaks with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon, and we'll hear from CAI's Eve Zukoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We have a lot to get to this week. A ballot recount has concluded in a close Republican primary on the Upper Cape, but one candidate plans to challenge the mail-in ballots in court. Plus, we have new details on the auction of offshore wind areas off the Outer Cape. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to talk about those stories and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hello, Steve.
So let's start with the news on the ballot recount. This is to determine which Republican will be running for state senate on the Upper Cape and part of Plymouth County, that election coming up in just a month and a half. Give us the recount results.
Sure. So the result here is that the initial winner did prevail in the recount. That is Matt Muratori, who is a current state representative for the Plymouth area. And he will be the Republican Senate candidate in this district, the Plymouth and Barnstable district. Carrie McRae, who was the other candidate in the Republican primary, did gain 6 votes in the recount, but the margin is still 39 votes with Muratori as the winner. And those numbers are from the Secretary of State's office. So on November 5th, Election Day, Muratori will be facing the Democrat in this race, who is Dylan Fernandez of Falmouth. And as we've said on the news roundup before, that really promises to be a very interesting and competitive race because both of them are sitting state representatives with their own constituencies already in place. This district, although it's called Plymouth and Barnstable, does not actually include the town of Barnstable because those names are based on the county. So if you vote in Bourne, in Falmouth, in Mashpee, or in Sandwich on the Cape, then this is your Senate race, Muratori versus Fernandez. And the town of Plymouth is also in the district, along with 3 other towns in Plymouth County.
So after the recount, just 39 votes separating these two Republican candidates, McRae says she isn't done challenging the results. She's objecting to how some of the mail-in ballots were counted. Tell us, what are some of the problems that she's alleging here?
Yes, well, as you said, this is about the mail-in ballots specifically. And McRae's allegation is that in Plymouth, election officials counted ballots that arrived in unsigned envelopes. You're supposed to sign the envelope when you mail it, and the inner envelope. She also alleges that officials failed to stamp some of those mail-in ballots to show that they were received on time. And she says that towns are required to verify the signatures on mail-in ballots. It's not just guidance, she says, but a firm requirement. And she alleges that Plymouth was not verifying signatures. For this action, it seems McRae's main focus really is on the counting in Plymouth, which is happened to be where her opponent lives, and it's the largest population center in the district. But she said that she also wants to look at how other towns in the district handled their own mail-in ballots.
And what's the next step here? She says she's taking it to court.
Yes. So as of Tuesday, when I talked with Carrie McRae, she said she was planning to file a civil lawsuit in Superior Court probably by today, and regarding that handling of the mail-in ballots. I asked her who the defendants would be. Would it only be Plymouth? She didn't want to say. She also wouldn't disclose who her lawyer would be on this case. She did volunteer, though, before I had a chance to ask, that she is planning to accept whatever the result is of these legal remedies. She said, you know, once the legal process is complete, she will accept that result. And if Muratori's win is upheld, she will completely support him as the Republican candidate in the Senate seat.
Now she's pointing
Senate race
in the Senate race.
Right.
She's
yeah.
pointing to the way that the town of Plymouth handled the mail-in ballots. What is the town of Plymouth saying about these allegations?
Well, I contacted the town clerk and also the communications coordinator for the town. but they would not initially make any comment for my story. I did have some hope that they might be kind of figuring out how to respond, so I tried again later, but I was not able to reach them again. I also asked for a comment from the Muratori campaign. They pointed to a press release they had issued declaring victory in the race. And in that press release, Muratori said the primary was safe, smooth, and secure. And he says his focus now is on that general election run against Dylan Fernandez.
Okay, let's move on to the news about new offshore wind areas off the Outer Cape. The federal government has scheduled an auction of leases for October 29th, but the areas are a little different from what was proposed before, right? Tell us about what's happening here.
Yes, if listeners have tuned into these Outer Cape offshore wind areas in the past, or if you attended the East Ham meeting in July and saw the map that they had there, the federal government has shrunk the wind lease area in response to information that they've received during this public comment period. The wind area is 12% smaller, so not a huge drop, but it does amount to about 117,000 fewer acres than before. The agency that does this is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And they said that in making those decisions, they listened to concerns from the fishing industry, from people concerned about navigation issues, the Coast Guard, and also to federal officials with authority over marine wildlife, the National Marine Fisheries Service. The concerns for fishing that they identified as making a difference here were mainly about herring and groundfish. And then on the wildlife side of it, it's about habitat for coral and for right whales. But in terms of the effect here for Cape residents, the 12% cut in the acreage does not move the turbines farther from Cape Cod. The biggest changes to these areas are actually on the portion that's farthest from Cape Cod already. So the turbines off the Outer Cape would still start about 25 miles offshore.
So about 25 miles off the Outer Cape. Remind us, kind of give us some context around this. Remind us a bit about what this auction means for the overall planning of offshore wind, because this process is complicated and proceeds in these kind of these different steps that overlap.
Yes, there are many overlapping steps for each separate wind area. So again, this is off the Outer Cape, and what the auction will be really is a launching off point. The auction involves developers buying leases on areas of ocean where the federal government has decided to allow offshore wind farms. There are eight of them right now in the Gulf of Maine. And when we use that name, Gulf of Maine, we do want to point out that six of the eight areas are closer to the Cape than to Maine. But the developers go through this process. They actually have to be qualified by the federal government to participate in the auction. There are quite a few. 14 bidders have been qualified this time around. Some of them are familiar names like Avangrid, and some of them, at least I am not familiar with. The process is they're bidding, they're to buy a lease. That's what this auction is. They're auctioning off the leases to these areas. But getting a lease doesn't mean they're ready to build. They still have a long way to go. They have to plan their whole project. They have to go through a federal permitting process, and they have to find a buyer for the power. Selling that power in Massachusetts typically involves going through the state bid process that we've talked about before for the area south of the islands. So all of that would still be ahead for these wind areas off the Outer Cape. But certainly, yeah, the leasing really jumpstarts the whole thing because it means that then these corporations have made an investment in putting wind farms in those locations. So, they then have a dog in the race, have a horse in the race, and they are moving forward with their investment.
Before you go, I want to talk to you about an event you attended this week that deals with planning and policy issues across the Cape and Islands. It's the One Cape Summit. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so One Cape is an annual conference sponsored by the Cape Cod Commission. It lasts for 2 days, and this year it was held at the Witchmere Beach Club in Harwich Port. The idea is to bring together officials from across the Cape and also some subject matter experts from outside the Cape, off the Cape, to talk about public policy issues that are important here and what to do next about them. Usually it's focused on things that the Cape Cod Commission does a lot of work on. These are things like housing, wastewater, land use, climate, water quality, and so on. So they had some speakers, sort of bigger name speakers like the Lieutenant Governor, Yvonne Howe, the State Secretary for Economic Development, and then subject matter experts on planning and so forth. It was a full agenda.
Briefly, what was a topic that stood out to you that people may want to keep an eye on?
Well, sure. I attended a breakout session on the idea of establishing a Capewide housing land bank and community land trust specifically for affordable housing. The Cape Cod Commission has hired a consultant to look at this issue. It's really about the intersection of housing and conservation. Land trusts have been used usually for conservation, but this is the idea of taking some of those principles and applying them to finding places for affordable housing.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
The head of the Steamship Authority will step down after a summer of frustration for many passengers of the ferry line. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times is here with the story. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Robert Davis, Bob Davis as he's known, announced Tuesday that he will step down as the general manager of the Steamship Authority. It was kind of a surprise announcement, but in another way, it was kind of not. Start by telling us maybe about the announcement itself and what we know about how this change could happen.
Yeah, right. That's a good way to put it. So leading up to Tuesday, the Steamship Board has had a number of closed-door meetings over the last few months just about his contract. So we knew something was going on. We're not, privy to what was said in those meetings yet, but I think we can kind of safely assume that had the board been satisfied with the status quo, Davis would probably still be general manager. And I think it's fair to say the biggest critics on board have been representatives from Falmouth and the Vineyard. That's likely reflective of the communities they represent. As we see the Vineyard, residents not been satisfied with the ferry lines, we can get into a little bit. But right, Davis has been with the steamship for almost four decades. He started as an auditor, kind of worked his way up through the ranks, and eventually took over from Wayne Lanson in 2017 as general manager. And kind of right out the gates, he didn't have a great luck. 2018 might have been one of the more infamous years for the ferry line. We can get to that too. But Tuesday, he announced he was stepping down to serve in an advisory capacity while they find a replacement over the next year. And we were told it's going to be kind of a national or even global search.
There is a lot going on at the Steamship Authority. We know that they've got new boats coming online, that they're freight boats that they've been having kind of remade, and they're expected to show up here soon. That project has run over cost by a significant amount. A lot of people pointing at the reservation system, saying it's kind of an antiquated system, and the Steamship Authority has been leaning in, trying to modernize it, and has yet to produce anything in that way, but has spent a significant amount of money for the website and reservation system. And then this past summer, there were a lot of cancellations right in the middle of this high season. So, I don't know, pick apart one of those and explain what some of the frustration that's been growing here is about.
Yeah, I mean, I take a step back and argue this has been really a long time in the works. About a year ago, the board gave its annual review, and there were three really high scores. New Bedford, Hyannis, and Nantucket really liked them, while Falmouth and Martha's Vineyard, as we were explaining before, basically gave failing grades. So it's really interesting. Where's the rub there? But shortly after that review, some kind of unflattering details came out about the sanctity drifting away from the dock, as folks probably remember. And the administration then was really criticized for keeping the board in the dark. And I think those kind of tensions between the two sides really grew there. And then, right, you had this kind of substantial issues this summer. Even before the summer started, you had crew shortages that have led to a lot of cancellations, not to the degree of 2018 when there were something like 500 cancellations before the summer even started, But these were during like pivotal busy weekends. One was school vacation when folks were coming home. There was a crew shortage. And we heard from families that were kind of stuck getting over. We also had what board members call the disaster of the weekend, kind of the height of the summer. People were having a hard time getting off. We had a photo of a line trying to get onto the ferry at, I think it was 4 in the morning. It was back way down Beach Road. And right, as you were saying, it's not just these cancellations. I think a big one is the reservation system. It seems like every year, the website seems to just go down when folks are trying to book a reservation and they're stuck in line for hours. But right. So, you know, Davis didn't say these are the reasons why he's stepping down. But it's fair to say there's been a lot of pressure from the board and the public.
Okay, let's just take a quick minute here to look at what the process will be going forward, what we know about what's going to happen now, because he made this announcement, but he's not stepping down right now.
Right, yeah, he's on for a year. I think, you know, these discussions were done in executive session, and I think going forward, we're still going to learn, you know, what's part of this for him to step down. You know, I don't want to get too into it, but, you know, when anyone at such a high position steps down, there's generally some finance involved. But there's also going to be, you know, I think the big thing going forward is this search, and we don't know the details yet, but, you know, as we kind of wrote in an editorial this week, if they don't do a good search, we could just be stuck right where we are right now. So I think the board, you know, made this decision, or, well, they didn't necessarily make this decision, but, you know, they have a lot of work going forward.
That is Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, where you can read all about it. Sam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Chatham held a special town meeting this week to consider spending on a big waterfront project. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with details. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. This is called the 90 Bridge Street Waterfront Project. It's a big multi-part project with an $11 million overall price tag. It needed about $4 million from the town to reach that completion number. Tell us what happened this week.
Well, at the special town meeting Monday, there was considerable debate over this project, which has been in the works for almost a decade, really. And the project ended up passing by a vote of 462-99, which is well within the number needed to pass because of the money is going to be borrowed. It needed a two-thirds majority. So that was obtained in this at the meeting. There was some debate back and forth about whether this project was needed. There were some people who objected to the amount of money being spent here. But the town's shellfish constable, Renee Gagne, countered that with the fact that the major aspect of this project is going to be a new upwelling shellfish grow-out system for the town. The town's current upweller is jury-rigged and unreliable, and the town's shellfishing industry, which is the largest wild-caught commercial quahog shellfishery in the state, really depends on growing out seed in the upweller to help bolster the wild shellfishery. So she made that case, and there were others who made the case for the fact that the upweller will be housed in a historic Coast Guard boathouse, which has been kept on in a boatyard up in Quincy for a number of years, awaiting approval of this project. This boathouse used to house the famous CG-36500 rescue boat, and some folks at town meeting said, you know, the town lost ownership of that boat to Orleans decades ago, and they don't want to lose another aspect of the town's heritage, historical heritage. So the boathouse will add to that by and be repurposed in a very functional way in this project.
And I want to ask you about another story. In Orleans, the town is considering creating a walking and bike way to Nauset Beach along Beach Road. But neighbors here are suggesting that it's maybe not a good idea, that it could change the character of the town for the worse. Explain what's happening.
That's right. In May, voters authorized $85,000 for a feasibility study that would toward a multi-use path that would basically stretch from down Beach Road, which is the main road to Nauset Beach. And the idea is to make this road safer for pedestrians and bicyclists and other non-motorists. There have been a few incidents along this road over the past several years that raised some safety concerns. But a group of residents who live along the road or in the neighborhood, calling themselves Save Beach Road, have organized and are opposing this project. They say they don't want it to change, as you said, Steve, the character of this section of the town. They say, you know, they don't want it to become the Jersey Shore or Orange County, California. But town officials counter that, you know, there needs to be some accommodation for these alternate modes of transportation. Right now, they haven't started the study yet, but they have hired a consultant, and a couple of the options involve on-road bike lanes. There's also the option of making a separate sidewalk and a separate bike lane that are off the road. These are all things that the consultant will study over the next few months, but residents, they're adamant that they feel that this is really going to change the character of their area of town, and they'd like to stop it at this point.
Are they concerned about land takings along the road? Is that what some of this may be?
That's one of the concerns. You know, every time you hear about the addition of a bike path or a multi-use path, there's always the possibility that there could be some land takings in order to make to accommodate such a structure. But the town officials say, you know, we don't know yet if that's going to be the case. The safest method may not involve any road takings, but they want to go through with the study in order to show the best avenue forward. And they're saying that, you know, at least let us do the study, then we can come back and we can debate whether these are the best solutions for the town.
That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Provincetown last year passed a town meeting article limiting new ownership of multiple short-term rentals, essentially trying to tamp down corporate ownership and investment properties in that market. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with a closer look at how many of those really exist and who this may apply to. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
We're talking about kind of Airbnbs here, and it turns out, at least at this point, short-term rentals are still mostly not overrun by corporate and multiple unit ownership. Your reporter, Paul Benson, looked at this. Tell us what he found.
Yes, Paul did an analysis of the number of these short-term rentals in Provincetown, looking at both the town's list of short-term rental certificates that have been issued and the State Department of Revenue's list of short-term rentals. Of course, the state now collects taxes on those Airbnb rentals, et cetera. And what he found was that only about 10% of the current owners hold three or more certificates or had three or more short-term rental accounts with the state. And that's as of this past April, when the new bylaw that was passed at the special town meeting last October, as you mentioned, took effect when it was approved by the state attorney general's office. There's reason to believe, though, that the bylaw has had its intended effect.
Well, we'll talk about that a little bit. Some of the concern here, as I was suggesting, is about people buying up properties, multiple properties, as an investment and really removing that housing stock from the town. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And of course, this is happening not just in Provincetown, but in other communities as well. And I know that there are other towns that are considering these kinds of regulations. So what Provincetown did was first to ban corporations owning short-term rental certificates and to limit the number of certificates that any individual can have to two. So for example, when Paul looked at the recent real estate transactions in Provincetown, he found that there was a cluster of them in early 2023 showing exactly the type of investment activity that the bylaw aimed to prevent. One LLC called Puck's Folly, which is controlled by two people from the town of Billerica, sold a parking lot in Cambridge for $9.4 million in January of 2023. Then in February, Puck's Folly bought a $2.9 million house on Martha's Vineyard. In March, a five-bedroom house on Commercial Street in Provincetown, formerly the Martin House Restaurant, for $2.8 million. In April, a single-family house on Bayberry Avenue in Provincetown for $1.9 million. And a condo on Mechanic Street in Provincetown for $665,000. So the total purchases in that short period was $8.2 million. Mm. All four of those properties were listed as short-term rentals. So under the new bylaw, that LLC, Puck's Folly, could not do any more of this kind of investment activity.
About how many short-term rentals in total does Provincetown have? I know that Paul was looking at this.
Yes. According to the town's records, there are just over 900 short-term rental certificates. There's a website called AirDNA that tracks data on short-term rentals, and it shows about 1,000 short-term rentals in the town of Provincetown. And what Paul found in his analysis was that there were a total of about 100 units that are owned by people or LLCs that have three or more. Most of those were people who had just three residential units, usually on the same property. There were six people who had four or five, three people had six. And the total, as I said, is about 100 who were owners of three or more.
There's a lot of data here in the article. You can read all about it at the Provincetown Independent, their website. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
We're going to stick with the topic of short-term rentals. On Nantucket, a special town meeting considered how to regulate short-term rentals. Again, these are like Airbnbs. And if it sounds familiar to you, well, it's only happened for, I think, the last five town meetings on the island. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current joins us with the big reveal. How did it go this time at our town meeting? Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
So tell us, how did it go at town meeting? Did they regulate these short-term rentals?
Well, this has been the question, as you mentioned, at the top for the last 4 years on Nantucket. And a zoning bylaw amendment to write the short-term rental use into our zoning code has failed four times previously, and it failed once again on Tuesday at our special town meeting. And this has been just a very tough question for people to answer. The voters are split on this question. Town leaders have been putting this in, articles in, to write this into the zoning code for several years to address this sort of legal limbo that we find ourselves in with neighbors suing neighbors over operating short-term rentals because it's not explicitly written into the zoning code, saying that this is a commercial use in a residential district that should not be allowed. So the zoning amendment was really, a way to try to answer that question while also putting some guardrails and address the really strong concerns that a lot of people have about the impacts that short-term rentals are having on, people's quality of life, neighborhoods, and whether they, you know, year-round housing is being converted into short-term rentals. So there was a competing article from...
So tell us about the two articles. Yes, there were two articles on the town meeting, and both of them were defeated ultimately, but they offered kind of slightly different visions of how to regulate the short-term rental market.
Yeah, so the first one, Article 1, was a what was described as a compromise article between the select board and a number of competing citizen petitions that have been put forward, and they, you know, came together with what they called a compromise article that would come up with a new definition to put into the zoning code, a Nantucket vacation rental, put some restrictions and limits on the number of turnovers in the summer, and a number of other guardrails that they felt struck a good balance between getting out of the sort of legal limbo that we're in while putting in some guardrails for people and some protections to address the issues of quality of life. That failed. It required a two-thirds vote. It didn't even get a majority, similar to a previous vote that we did in May at the annual town meeting with another sort of compromise article. The second was a article that was put forward by a political action group called Put Nantucket Neighborhoods First. And the idea behind this article was to define in the zoning code short-term rentals and as an accessory use, basically saying that they are allowed by, you know, in all residential districts as long as it is a subordinate use to the primary use of a dwelling. So as long as the property owner is living and staying in their house longer than they're renting it, short-term rentals are allowed. And really getting at this idea that there are a lot of people and investors buying homes just to rent them out, not to live in them, just to run them as a business. And that was really sort of the thrust of that article, which did gain a majority vote, but did not meet the two-thirds threshold that it needed.
Now, you pointed to the fact that there's these lawsuits happening, one very high-profile lawsuit that's really forcing the issue here, because a judge at one point said that the zoning code does not specifically allow short-term rentals in residential areas, which means that they shouldn't be allowed except as some accessory use. So without a town meeting article actually moving into the zoning, what happens going forward now? I mean, are people not allowed to have short-term rentals? What happens?
No, short-term rentals are, well, I guess that would depend on who you ask. But the town, from the town's point of view, short-term rentals are absolutely allowed. And all of the town meeting votes were playing out against the backdrop of hashing out the remand from the court. The court, as you said, heard that case, said that they are not allowed as a primary use, but could be allowed as an accessory use, and the zoning board needed to clarify whether the property in question in this lawsuit was in fact an accessory use. Just before that meeting, the Zoning Board of Appeals on Nantucket did rule in favor of that short-term rental, did say that it qualified as accessory use, subordinate use, and of course, we're going to be seeing more litigation. The plaintiff in that case has vowed to appeal. The political action groups that have been supporting her are vowing to appeal that case. So we're going to see that back at the Massachusetts Land Court and to see if the Land Court judge finds what was done by the zoning board was valid or not. So more to come on that. You know, the litigation is not over. I'm sure we'll be back in the spring talking about short-term rentals again at our annual town meeting in 2025.
It's Jason Graziadei of the Nantucket Current. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to a break now. When we come back, we'll hear from our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, and we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Overdose prevention and jobs, those topics were at the top of activity on Beacon Hill this week. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, about those issues. Here's their conversation.
Hey, Gilda. Good morning.
This week, you reported that Beacon Hill lawmakers are trying to find a compromise on two different versions of an overdose prevention bill that passed in the House and the Senate. What similarities do these two versions of the bill share, and what makes them different?
Yeah, there's a lot of common ground between the bills, with Democrats in both branches really united on the idea that Massachusetts still needs to do more to tackle the opioid crisis. So these bills would both boost access to overdose reversal drugs, Narcan, and drug testing equipment so people can know if the drugs they're using are contaminated. They'd also create a new license and oversight structure for recovery coaches and make changes to the state's child welfare laws so that parents who are on medication to treat opioid use disorder wouldn't need to be reported. And then the big difference really is that the Senate in its bill went further than the House. It created language that would clear a path for cities and towns that want to do so to open up facilities known as overdose prevention centers or safe injection sites, supervised consumption sites, whatever term you choose to use, the places where people can go to use with medical supervision illegal drugs that they've obtained elsewhere. That's really the big flashpoint between the two bills.
And so what's next for this overdose prevention bill? Is there any sort of timeline for when a compromise has to be reached?
So it's before a 6 lawmaker negotiating committee, 3 senators and 3 state reps. And they have really until the new session begins in January to try and reach a deal. The complicating factor is that the legislature is set to meet only in informal sessions through the end of the year, which is usually not a time you can pass controversial bills, which means trouble potentially for the overdose prevention center's language, which has had some blowback, because in these types of sessions that are happening for the next few months, any one lawmaker's objection can block a bill from progressing. So we'll stay tuned there and see what happens.
Now looking to another story you had this week, the Special Commission on the State's Emergency Shelter System met this week and talked about work authorizations for migrants. Can you tell us what role do work authorizations play in the sustainability of the state shelter system? And what did commissioners have to say about work authorizations?
Part of the problem that Massachusetts is running into with its shelter crisis is that it just costs so much to buy a house or rent a home here that, you know, people need jobs to make income to get out of shelter. There have been shelter stays of more than a year because it's so expensive to move into more stable housing. So the Healey administration has really keyed in on the idea of getting new migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, people who are newly here authorized to work in the U.S. And we heard this week that the numbers are continuing to rise of people who are new to the U.S. and now authorized to work here. Almost 4,000 migrants living in shelter are now authorized to work in the U.S., which the commission members see as a hopeful sign of progress in easing this crisis.
Can you remind us quickly who sits on this special state shelter commission and what is its ultimate goal?
Yeah, it's led by Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll. It includes lawmakers from both parties. It includes service providers and other people who work with homeless families and immigrants. And its goal is to really find a path forward so that the shelter system can stay financially sustainable, continue to house people without blowing a huge hole in the state budget.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with our Statehouse reporter, Katie Lannon. This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. The International Fund for Animal Welfare is reporting a record-breaking number of dolphin strandings on Cape Cod this year. And this week, the numbers reached a new high. CAI's Eve Zukov has details on this story and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Walk us through the stranding event that IFAW responded to on Monday.
Sure. Well, on Monday, the IFAW team got called out to Brewster, where 14 bottlenose dolphins were stranded at Linnell Landing. And this was a major undertaking for the team because bottlenose dolphins are typically larger. They're much more robust than other local dolphin species that IFAW typically works with. And they're also typically found further from shore, so it's really unusual to see bottlenose dolphins stranded. In fact, this was the largest bottlenose dolphin mass stranding in the Northeast region in recorded history. Mm. But the IFAW team, they jumped in. Unfortunately, 3 of the animals had already died, but they worked with the tide to refloat 11 of the others. One has a satellite tag attached, so the team has seen the pod stay around Cape Cod Bay after successfully being refloated, kind of sent back out to sea. But the fact they're in Cape Cod Bay is concerning because it means that the chance of re-stranding is high. The team's really hoping that they get out of the bay, head into the ocean, and continue their migration, wherever that may be.
And it's not just the bottlenose dolphins that make this dolphin stranding season one that's breaking records,
no,
right?
No. The sheer numbers are crazy. In the last 2 weeks alone, IFAW's team has responded to 26 stranded dolphins. Overall, they've responded to 175 live stranded dolphins since June, which is more than 2.5 times their annual average, and there are still 3 months left in the year. So the IFAW team leader told me that they fear these strandings are just not over. Even though the team members need a rest, they need to repair equipment, it could really be a while.
I guess big question here, do experts know why the numbers have reached such highs?
Well, there's some existing knowledge that we should talk about, right? So Cape Cod's shallow waters are complex tidal movements and sandbars. They often disorient dolphins. They make it a global hotspot for strandings. It's been that way for decades. But in the last year, the number of strandings has really increased. And scientists think that that could be because of how warming waters have made Cape Cod Bay more accommodating to unusual fish species, the ones that used to be seen more south of Long Island. And look, the dolphins are just following them to catch a meal. So that appears to be, this appears to be kind of a climate change story.
So many dolphins, they migrate seasonally. Is this record-breaking stranding year coming to an end? You talked about it, the fact that it may just have more to come.
Yeah, the IFAW team is saying now more than ever, basically, they just really need people on their beach walks to keep an eye out. And we have a number on our website if people do find a stranded dolphin.
Mm. Okay, for the final piece of the show here, I'd like to do something a little bit different. We're going to keep Eve Zukoff with us, and we're going to bring back CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, do we have you with us?
Yes, we do.
Yes. So so let me set the scene for listeners. On Monday, a boat departed from Falmouth Harbor. On it were 15 members of the New England News Collaborative. Those are journalists from public radio stations from around New England. Jeanette and Eve and I were aboard, along with fellow CAI staff member Liz Lerner. And there were journalists from Maine Public Radio and from BUR in Boston and from GBH in Boston and from the Publix Radio in Rhode Island and from Connecticut, too. And we pooled our resources so that we could all go out to see for ourselves what few people have seen up close and in person, the wind turbines 15 miles south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. And we brought along with us three academic and scientific experts. And this was a journalistically independent trip. We had no one from Vineyard Wind, the offshore wind company, with us. These were all reporters that have been covering offshore wind one way or the other. And for pretty much all of us, including the scientific experts, it was a first look at these turbines out in the ocean, standing out there. So I want to start, I'm going to ask each of you, Jeanette and Eve, what your impressions were, but let me start by saying that I think nothing really prepares you for the scale of what we saw. These turbines are a mile apart. Each one is 900 feet tall up to the tip of the blade. There are already 30 or so of these already kind of constructed out there and many others still under construction. The tops of them are sometimes in the clouds because they're so tall. It was just a monumental vision and a little bit otherworldly. Jeanette, I know you spent some time with Sanjay Arwadi. He's an engineering professor with an expertise in offshore wind. Tell us a little bit about him and his impressions.
Sure. Sanjay Arwadi is a professor of civil engineering who teaches offshore wind related courses at UMass Amherst. And actually, the university has a new center for offshore wind called the Arrow Center, and he's the director of it. So he is very interested in this. And as you said, it was his first time seeing them in person. And you could really see a sort of a sense of excitement on his face and in his voice as they were coming into view, although it happens very slowly, right? Because first you just kind of see, we came around Chappaquiddick and you see this little break in the horizon, and then they become you know, larger and larger slowly. But he said this idea of scale really was on his mind as he saw the turbines, because it's something that's challenging for him to get across to students, to get them to appreciate in the classroom just how massive they are. And when we asked him about his thoughts on offshore wind, he said when he looks at the turbines, he's thinking about the absence of a coal-fired power plant on shore, because that's what these are replacing. And Americans are going to keep using electricity probably more than ever. So it's going to come from these turbines. Let's take a listen to what Sanjay Arwadi had to say about that. Here's the clip.
If we're operating from a place where we know that we want to be able to turn the light switches on and run the air conditioners and drive electric cars, if that's something we choose to do, the power is going to come from somewhere. And the choice of no, not that, or the statement no, not that, isn't complete without the then what part of it.
Right. So yeah, for him, the then what, the good answer to then what is offshore wind.
So you could hear him on the deck of the boat there speaking as we were traveling out to the wind farm. Eve, you spent a lot of time on that boat with an expert on North Atlantic right whales, Michael Moore. You helped enlist him to come out on this journey. Why Michael Moore?
Well, I brought Michael Moore because there are a lot of concerns about right whales and offshore wind. We know that North Atlantic right whales, one of the most critically or the most critically endangered whale species in the world, does spend time off of our shores, and there is a ton of misinformation also out there about how right whales might interact with offshore wind. But there are also a lot of real concerns that have to do with increased vessel traffic, creating more collisions between boats and right whales. Could offshore wind, you know, all the kind of industry out there, introduce more ropes to the water that gets them entangled? There are some concerns about sound that are being studied. There are concerns about how offshore wind could impact their favorite food, right whale's favorite food, these little copepods that kind of grow in or they kind of exist in masses and clumps. So there are a lot of real questions out there. And I wanted Michael Moore, who's been studying North Atlantic right whales for decades, to have a look and give us a sense of what he saw.
And briefly, his impressions, as he had seen some wind turbines before out in the water, but this was a real opportunity for him. He jumped at the chance to come on the boat with the journalists and get a real up-close look at these turbines.
Yeah, I think when I sent him the pitch email, it was an immediate sure exclamation point. No questions asked. For him, I mean, at one point he said that the turbines themselves were magnificent. Like he was struck by the engineering feat. But we also spent a lot more time talking about his unease seeing them, taking in the scale, thinking about all the unknowns. I mean, he described them as looking out at this field of offshore wind farms, offshore wind turbines, and he saw just question marks laid out in front of him.
We have just about a minute here. Jeanette, I just want to ask you, when you got home and tried to describe this, how was that for you? Like, what kind of, I found myself running out of words trying to describe to people what we saw out there on the ocean.
Yes, well, the scale of it, of course, is still a big part of it. For me personally, I've done so much reporting on the height of the turbines in the past that kind of wasn't too surprising to me. The thing that struck me more was kind of the vastness of the spacing, right? And I wanted to see what does a mile look like in between these turbines when you're close to them, and as you see them go out in the distance. You know, I counted about six turbines that you could see, like in each row, looking out to the horizon, and they get smaller and smaller into the horizon. They just recede there into the distance. And someday, you know, you'll be able to look in more than one direction and see them all out there generating renewable energy.
We will be posting photos and more on our Instagram. We've already had some up there. If you haven't followed us, follow us on Instagram. We have great drone footage as well, and keep an eye out for that to give you a sense of what is happening out there on the water. Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
I want to thank all our guests today. We also heard from Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Of course, CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program Sharks Turn Tail Whenever They Hear His Name is a Big Fish. Dan Treidel, thank you. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.